From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we examine recent political and ethnic fighting in South Africa with journalist Stephen Mufson, author of the new book Fighting Years, Black Resistance and the Struggle for a New South Africa. Also today, the man who killed Laura Palmer. Actor Ray Wise played Leland Palmer on the TV series Twin Peaks. We'll find out what he was up to before he was a possessed murderer. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg explains why slang ain't what it used to be. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush announced today that he hopes to sign the long-awaited Strategic Nuclear Weapons Treaty at a summit with Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev in February. The president also granted temporary trade privileges to ease food shortages in the Soviet Union. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Bush and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze met today and publicly announced their hope that a treaty would be signed at an upcoming three-day summit in Moscow. President Bush also announced that in response to pleas from the Soviet Union for economic assistance, he'll waive temporary trade restrictions and grant credit guarantees for the purchase of agricultural commodities. In addition, the U.S. will provide assistance in food distribution and send over emergency medical supplies. The action's a shift in administration policy. The president in the past has ruled out waiving what's called the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, which was designed to punish the Soviet Union for its restrictive emigration policies aimed at Jews and other minorities. Shevardnadze says the Supreme Soviet is considering passage of a more liberal emigration act. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Leaders of South Africa's major black nationalist groups called today for an end to factional fighting in the township of Thokoza. Police said that 124 people have been killed since the conflict began on Sunday. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela and Zulu leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi toured different sections of the township today. They issued separate calls for an end to the fighting. Despite continued fighting by their groups, the two leaders haven't met for direct talks. Hardline ANC leaders have reportedly charged Buthelezi with being an agent of the South African government. Iraq has announced that it's replacing its Minister of Defense with a battle-hardened veteran of the Iran-Iraq War. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
Iraq's new defense minister is Saadi Toma Abbas, the inspector general of Iraq's armed forces and the man credited with saving the southern port city of Basra during the Iran-Iraq War when Iran was launching human wave attacks against Iraq. Abbas, called a hero, replaces 70-year-old Abdul-Jabbar Khalil Shanshal. It's the second major reshuffle in Saddam Hussein's hierarchy in a month. Analysts say Shanshal may have disagreed with Saddam's strategy on Kuwait or supported negotiations. In any case, Saddam Hussein has now surrounded himself with hardliners with respect to Kuwait, which may be a sign he's not willing to negotiate a Kuwaiti withdrawal. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman, Jordan.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today, driven up in a late rally that was evidently sparked by rumors of a peace overture from Iraq. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 36 points to close at 2,622.28. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-3 in active trading. Volume was 182 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stephen Mufson, is a journalist who witnessed much of the black uprising in South Africa from 1984 to 86. Evidence of a rebellious spirit was everywhere during these fighting years, he says. To suppress public displays of protest, the government called up tens of thousands of troops and twice declared a state of emergency. More than 2,500 people were killed in political violence. Mufson wrote about South Africa for the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, and the New Republic. The government of South Africa expelled him in 1987. Mufson is now a staff writer for The Washington Post and has written a new book about the mid-80s called Fighting Years, Black Resistance and the Struggle for a New South Africa. He's now completing an article analyzing the events of 1990 in South Africa for publication in the next edition of Foreign Affairs. Factional violence between black South Africans in the Natal province has killed at least 4,000 people since 1986. Much of the conflict is between supporters of the African National Congress and members of the Zulu Inkatha movement led by Chief Gotcha Buthelezi. I asked Stephen Muffson about the political differences between the two groups.
Well, I think to understand the differences, you need to go back to describe what the relationship between them has been over the years. Chief Buthelezi was a member of the African National Congress. He was a member of the Youth League in the late 40s, and he was expelled from university for his work with the ANC Youth League involving a visit of a government official to the campus where he was a student. And he later went to work within some government structures as a chief of the Buthelezi clan, which required government approval, and later as chief minister of the KwaZulu homeland. And I think throughout this time, there was no rift between Chief Buthelezi and the ANC. There's always been an element of ANC thought which believed that you could use and participate in government structures and use them as tools to gain more power and to gain political rights. And Chief Buthelezi went into the KwaZulu homeland structure with the approval, with the very quiet approval of the ANC. And in fact, things worked out very much the way the ANC hoped. Chief Buthelezi became chief minister. He refused to accept independence for the homeland, thereby throwing a monkey wrench into the government's plans for a grand apartheid that would make black citizens of separate independent countries and aliens in so-called white South Africa. And Chief Buthelezi also introduced ANC history in the KwaZulu schools. His political organization in Inkatha adopted ANC colors, the KwaZulu flag is the ANC flag. The Inkatha Youth Brigade uses the old ANC Youth Brigade uniforms. And I think things were very much on track until the late 70s.
What changed?
Things changed in the 1970s with the emergence of the Black Consciousness Movement. And the Black Consciousness Movement took a much harder line toward the question of participating in government structures. It saw this as futile, or as Biko said, it was like taking an unloaded gun and agreeing to a duel with someone. And it was just futile. And all it did, he thought, was to serve whites a myth that this was somehow a liberal country. And so they rejected this participation. The ANC, in an effort, eager to attract recruits from the legions of black consciousness students who were fleeing the country following the Soweto uprising, wanted to distance itself from Chief Buthelezi. And in 1979, it had a meeting with him in London, which the ANC wanted to keep secret, and Chief Buthelezi wanted to make public, his line always having been that he will not negotiate or speak to anyone behind the backs of his people. But I think he very much wanted to be associated with the ANC and not to be viewed as a so-called stooge, which is what the ANC started calling him. And in the early 80s, there were clashes between Chief Buthelezi's Inkatha organizations and various student organizations and United Democratic Front affiliates that were loosely allied to the ANC. And things went from bad to worse and became very deadly. And once people started dying in some of these fights and attacks, there was a lot of bad blood, and that's just gotten worse and worse over the course of the decade. And so a lot of it is personal. A lot of what divides black politics in South Africa is strategy, not so much principle. And this question of strategy, do you participate in organizations or do you boycott organizations, has been an important dividing line in black politics. And in some ways, these strategic issues are much more important than political ones.
Well, Buthelezi is opposed to economic sanctions, to violence, to boycotts, to strikes. I mean, what techniques would he be receptive to for fighting apartheid?
Well, that's exactly the question the ANC started asking after a while. I mean, here he seemed to oppose everything there was, and it was hard for them to see. It's hard for most people to see how the strategy of consumer boycotts, for example, really violates any sort of political principle. And I think this really, after a while, people started thinking, well, maybe he wasn't using the KwaZulu homeland to advance black political rights. Maybe he was using the KwaZulu homeland to advance his own ambitions. And I think the ANC decided that this is a man who's ambitious He does have a thin skin, and I think he was seen as someone who was going to sacrifice the interests of black South Africans for his own personal interests. The KwaZulu homeland, as you know, is heavily subsidized by the government, and it enabled him to dispense a lot of patronage. Moreover, the more you saw the way he ran the KwaZulu homeland, and the closer you look at the KwaZulu homeland, the more doubt is cast on some of the liberal notions that Chief Buthelezi is espousing. Chief Buthelezi does not run the KwaZulu homeland as a liberal democracy. The KwaZulu homeland is a one-party state. Inkatha is the one party that dominates that, and opposition is really not tolerated in the KwaZulu assembly.
How much of the fighting between ANC members and Zulu and Inkatha members is tribal, and how much of it do you think is political?
I think the fighting between ANC and Inkatha is not tribal at all, and I actually prefer not to use that word tribal because it suggests there's something barbarian about ethnic tension, which we don't say about ethnic tension elsewhere in the world where people massacre themselves over ethnic issues. But I think that it's important to realize that virtually all the fighting in Natal, which accounts for over 4,000 deaths in the last 3 years, has been between Zulus. Zulus of different political beliefs, Zulus who belong to different political organizations, because virtually everyone who lives in Natal, everyone who is black who lives in Natal, is Zulu.
And the fighting between the Zulus and Xhosas it was mostly Xhosas who founded the ANC. You think that's largely a political fight?
Well, it's not Xhosas who've mostly founded the ANC. The Mandela is a Xhosa, and Tambo is Xhosa, however, the ANC, from the time it was created in 1912, went to tremendous pains to not be allied clearly with one ethnic group. Chief Luthuli, who was the ANC president throughout the 50s and who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1961, was Zulu. And there are other leading members of the organization who are Zulu and who come from other tribes, from Sotho's and everything. And I think it's, if the ANC, more than any other political organization, has crossed ethnic boundaries, both ethnic and racial boundaries.
Do you think white conservatives in South Africa are using the fighting between Inkatha and the ANC as an excuse to slow down or oppose reforms?
Well, I think the fighting anywhere in the country, I think, serves the purposes of the white right wing, because what the government and the African National Congress are saying is that we can sit down like reasonable people and work out a resolution to the racial conflict, and that resolution will bring peace and stability to the country. And so anything that makes it seem as though that process of negotiating is not going to bring peace and stability, I believe, serves the interests of everyone who wants to see these negotiations fail. And I think that includes primarily the white right and some elements of black politics. I think to some extent Chief Buthelezi would not like to see that this negotiating process proceed peacefully without him. And I think the Pan-Africanist Congress has viewed the negotiating process as futile, and I think that the failure of that process would possibly serve their interests as well. But primarily, I think it's the white right that will gain the most from the failure of these talks.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is journalist Stephen Mufson, author of the new book Fighting Years, Black Resistance and the Struggle for a New South Africa. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Stephen Mufson, and he covered South Africa for 3 years, first for the Wall Street Journal and then for Business Week. He was expelled by the South African government in 1987. He's written an update on South Africa for the spring issue of Foreign Affairs. Mufson writes for the Washington Post and has a new book called Fighting Years. You were there in the mid-80s. You were there for 3 years, left in 1987. Did you feel that you felt resistance techniques, that you saw resistance techniques change over the 3 years that you were there?
No, I think that the resistance techniques in the mid-80s or throughout the 80s were relatively consistent. People paid attention to grassroots concerns that people had. Organizations paid attention to grassroots concerns that people had and tried to organize boycotts and consumer boycotts, rent boycotts, to try to apply pressure to the government. To some extent, techniques changed when the state of emergency was declared, both in 1985 and again in 1986, and a lot of people went underground. And that was the main development when I was there. So many people were on the run and in hiding.
And do you think being in hiding brought about a new form of resistance?
Well, I think that not so much a new form of resistance, but it turned some people toward the more militant forms of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
I think the amazing thing about the state of emergency is that the government felt that this would intimidate black South Africans and bring the situation under control. In fact, it did just the opposite, because the state of emergency affected everyone in the townships, no matter who they were. If you were an executive at an advertising agency, if you were a mine worker, if you were a clerk, no matter what your politics were, you got stopped at roadblocks, you were affected by the curfew. And in fact, the state of emergency was the greatest organizing tool for the opposition that could ever be thought of. And so there was a tremendous sense of awakening in South Africa, a political awakening when I was there. And I think that's the important part of the 80s. And to some extent, it's a result of hard organizational work by organizations like trade unions and the United Democratic Front. And part of it was the work of the government by slapping on a state of emergency that affected everyone.
You make an interesting point. You say in the mid-80s, the government feared it had made the ANC leaders into martyrs by arresting some and forcing others into exile. So instead of banning the United Democratic Front in the mid-80s or arresting its leaders, it arrested a lot of the mid-level leaders who couldn't be made into as famous martyrs as easily.
Well, I think that's right. And part of what I try to do in the book is to describe some of these people who are not international celebrities and not martyrs on a national level, but were really local leaders doing the sort of hard nuts and bolts work of organizing communities and doing the things that eventually turned the country upside down. And these people aren't particularly famous. And they're the people who bore the brunt of repression in the 1980s. And I think they're going to remain a big factor in the country in the 90s, a factor both for the government and for the ANC to reckon with. There are strong, savvy leaders throughout the country.
What do you think are some of the new questions that the ANC has had to face now that it's no longer a banned organization?
Well, the ANC is an organization in tremendous flux since its unbanning. For one thing, it has to reconstruct an organization inside the country after having operated in exile primarily. And that's very difficult. It's proving much more difficult than they expected. You know, exile is kind of a punishment and an escape. And there's a certain amount of responsibility you don't have to take when you're in exile. And now, as an organization in South Africa, on the ground, it's held responsible for things that it wasn't held responsible for before. And it's had to grapple with things it hasn't had to grapple before. For example, what is the proper relationship between the ANC and civic organizations? Should civic organizations remain independent and unaligned to the ANC and include people from AZAPO and the PAC and all sorts of other strains of politics, or should they join together? Should clergymen be both members of the clergy and activists in the ANC? Bishop Tutu has asked Anglican clergymen not to join the ANC or not to become leaders of the ANC. These are the kinds of things we take for granted here to some extent, although not entirely, but which the ANC is first having to deal with. What should be the role, for example, of a trade union leader? Should a black trade union leader give up his trade union post when he decides to go into politics and join the ANC? I think there are other questions for the ANC too. For example, is the ANC a broad liberation movement that includes people of different political persuasions, which is a position that would be very helpful in negotiating with the government, or is the ANC a political party with a definite set of beliefs?
What would be the difference in terms of what they could accomplish and how much force they'd have?
Well, to some extent, the two roles are at odds. I mean, if you're the broader they are and the less defined their platform, the bigger the advantage they have in negotiating a new constitution. But at the same time, other people are maneuvering for a position in a post-apartheid country and are mapping out positions. And the ANC's vagueness about some of the things it believes in on economics are losing its supporters or risk losing supporters. So they're in a tough position.
You say that the ANC is expected to call for an end to selected economic sanctions within the year. Why would they do that?
I think for two reasons. One is that sanctions are crumbling. There are Turkey, Hungary, Chile, Argentina, the Soviet Union, countries that have traded with South Africa before, as well as countries that have never traded with South Africa before, are starting to open economic relations with the country. So to some extent, their shift, which I think will come sometime next year, hasn't come yet. I think the ANC's shift on the question of sanctions will, to some extent, be a recognition of reality. But I think just as important is the recognition that the economic crisis in South Africa cannot wait until the end of liberation. And if the ANC waits another 2 or 3 years before it starts to deal with some of the really pressing economic problems in the country, it will be a tremendously destabilizing factor in a post-apartheid society. And that would not serve their interests.
But don't you think that supporting an end to certain sanctions can be seen as giving in to the white government?
Well, I think so, and I think that's why they haven't done it yet. The main one, there's been an important shift on the question of sanctions in the last year or two, and that is the linking of the lifting of sanctions to what's called an irreversible process of change. And that's a phrase now you're hearing everywhere. Is this process irreversible? And it's a good question in its own right, but it has a special legalistic connotation because if you believe the change is irreversible, you're not just saying that de Klerk's a good guy, but you're saying that perhaps you should lift sanctions. And so the ANC has been dancing around this question of whether or not change so far is on an irreversible course. And I think partly that's because they're trying to make up their minds, and partly because the implications of that would be to remove one of the main weapons that they've had in getting the government to the negotiating table. And I should say that I think that sanctions have made an impact on getting the government to the negotiating table. The sanctions have not brought the South African government to its knees, but it has slowed economic growth in the country for several years now and made it difficult to really make any headway. I think it's been a real factor in one factor in the government's thinking.
Journalist Stephen Mufsen is my guest, and he covered South Africa for 3 years for the Wall Street Journal, then for Business Week. He was expelled by the South African government in 1987. He's written a new book called Fighting Years, Black Resistance and the Struggle for a New South Africa. What do you think have been Nelson Mandela's greatest accomplishment since his release earlier this year?
Mandela's greatest accomplishment is in moving the process of negotiations forward.
Mm-hmm.
I think only someone of Mandela's stature could really accomplish that.
Yet there are many ways in which he's alienated his own admirers.
Well, I think so. And to some extent, that's to be expected. When you're in prison, people can ascribe any characteristics to you they like. And there's been an idealized idea of what Mandela is. It was inevitable that some people would be somewhat disappointed. In fact, it's extraordinary that more people haven't been disappointed. He is, as it turns out, an extraordinary person and incredibly sure of himself, remarkably lacking in bitterness, and a real sense of dignity and authority about him. However, he's a bit of a plodding speaker. He doesn't do tremendously well at big rallies. He has been seen by some people to be a little bit vacillating on certain issues. And most, I think some of his, the length of some of his foreign trips has surprised people, given how many pressing issues there are inside the country.
Negotiations between the government and the ANC are scheduled to start sometime in 1981. They'll be talking about a new constitution for South Africa. What other parties do you think have to join in these negotiations for them to really change life in South Africa for blacks?
Well, life in South Africa for blacks is going to change very slowly, no matter what happens at the negotiating table. The legacy of apartheid has been building up for so long that things just won't change overnight. But I think it is important to bring other people to the negotiating table because you want people to work within a new constitution. You don't want them working outside it to undermine it. And so I think the more people that can be brought to the negotiating table, the better. And it doesn't take a large number of people to disrupt the political process. And in South Africa, there are some very well-armed and determined people among the white community especially, but also among the black community. And the more people who participate in this process, the better.
Are you optimistic about these talks between the ANC and the government?
I'm very optimistic, despite all the problems. And I'm optimistic because I think both sides have committed themselves to the idea of negotiations and to the success of negotiations. And if negotiations were to fail, I think it would prove the opponents of the ANC and the National Party correct. These are opponents both to the right and to the left. And so I think that after being at odds for decades, the National Party's interests and the ANC's interests have suddenly converged. And I think that's a fundamental change. And I think that's one reason why, despite the horrendous violence in the country this year, that the ANC and the government have not been deterred from this process. I think in normal circumstances, you would have expected all the violence that's taken place to disrupt the negotiating process. And I think that time is also of the essence for both the ANC and the National Party. The National Party is eager to get this settled so that they do not have to hold another all-white election, and which would be required by 1994 otherwise. And I think the ANC believes that time is of the essence because a lot of the leaders of the ANC are very old men. Sisulu's in his late 70s. Mandela's in his early 70s. These are people who said back in the 1950s that they wanted to see freedom in their lifetimes. And here we are 35 years later, and I still think they're eager to see freedom in their lifetimes.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Stephen Mufson. His new book is Fighting Years, Black Resistance and the Struggle for a New South Africa. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For months, the most asked question on TV was who killed Laura Palmer. Coming up, we meet the answer. Actor Ray Wise talks with us about playing Leland Palmer, and he tells us how to do the Leland Shuffle. Also, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg revives some forgotten underworld slang. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has decided to grant the Soviet Union temporary trade privileges that will allow Moscow to buy U.S. farm products and ease their food shortages. Under the 1974 Jackson-Vanik Amendment, trade privileges are tied to an improvement in Soviet immigration policies. GOP Senator Robert Dole says that action is needed now to extend some $3 billion in credits to the Soviet Union. He said that the Soviets have enough grain to get them through the next 60 days. Hardships have led to rationing in some Soviet cities and a rising crime rate. Also in Washington, Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze had an unprecedented meeting with the leader of Angola's anti-communist rebel group, Jonas Savimbi. George Guetta reports from the State Department.
After their meeting at the Soviet embassy, Savimbi said he received assurances from Shevardnadze that the Soviets are interested in helping Angola achieve peace, stability, and democracy. It was a watershed meeting between the two. Savimbi's forces, with U.S. help, have been at war with the Soviet-backed leftist government for 15 years. Shevardnadze said once a ceasefire is agreed to, a suspension of arms deliveries to the Angolan government may be possible. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Baker had a meeting at the State Department with Angola's foreign minister, who said afterward that progress is being made towards a ceasefire. But before peace can be achieved, Savimbi's forces want assurances of full participation in a multi-party system in Angola. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
In Boston, Amtrak officials say that a trainee engineer was at the helm of an overnight train that smashed into a commuter train during rush hour this morning. The crash injured more than 250 people. David Wright of member station WBUR reports.
Amtrak officials told a news conference tonight that trainee engineer Richard Abramson was in control of the Night Owl when it leapt over the track, smashing into a Boston commuter train at 8:30 this morning. Amtrak spokesman Marty Rush says a qualified engineer was also on board.
It's not unusual for a trainee to operate trains, and it's the most sophisticated way to teach someone this aspect of our operations.
Officials from the National Transportation Safety Board are currently investigating the crash site. They say they will issue a formal statement sometime tomorrow. Meanwhile, hundreds of people are being treated at Boston area hospitals. Officials say the engineer of the Amtrak train and four rescue workers suffered the most serious injuries. Those five are in intensive care. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 36 points to close at 2,622.28 on volume of some 182 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 5-3 in active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. This interview is dedicated to our TV critic David Bianculli, who seldom lets a week go by without mentioning Twin Peaks on our show.
Did you kill Laura Palmer? That's a yes.
It was two Saturdays ago that Leland Palmer confessed to killing his daughter Laura Palmer. Right after the confession, the evil spirit Bob left Leland's body and Leland died, which means the actor who played him, Ray Wise, is out of the series. The perfect time, we thought, to ask Ray Wise to fill us in on what it was like to star on Twin Peaks. Since the premiere of Twin Peaks, the characters in the series and the TV viewers who watched it had asked the same question, who killed Laura Palmer? I asked Ray Wise when he found out.
I found out the morning after the Emmy Awards this last summer. And Mark Frost and David Lynch called me up to their office. Actually called Ben Horn, Richard Beamer and myself, and Cheryl Lee, who played Laura and who played Maddie Ferguson, up to the office, and we went into a small room that was devoid of furniture. It was very dark. This is true, with a kind of lava lamp in the corner. A lava lamp waterfall, as I recall. And David was sitting on the floor cross-legged, and so was Mark, and so was Cheryl Lee. And Richard and I came in, and we sat down cross-legged. And David leaned over and put his hand on my knee, and he said, "It was you." "It was always you from day one. It was you." And I sort of bowed my head and curled up in a fetal position and said, and I really can't say the word that I said at the time, but it was, "Oh, shoot."
Why were you upset?
I didn't want it to be me. You know, I grew to love Leland Palmer and his strange ways, and I didn't want it to be him. You know, it's like having a close friend turn out to be a killer and go to prison and all that sort of thing. I just didn't want it to be Leland. I wanted Leland to go on and on.
Did it ease the pain, though, knowing that in a way he was innocent? Because after all, he was possessed. It wasn't his own motivation that killed Laura Palmer.
Absolutely. Mark went on to explain my last show and the meaning of the last show. And they also filled me in on some of the background that I hadn't been aware of, that Bob had been inside me for the last 4 or 5 years. Yeah, Leland is a true innocent. In a sense, because he was totally possessed by this evil spirit, Bob, and so, yeah, when they told me that, it really took the edge off it for me, and I was able to accept it a lot better after that.
Did the writers know right from the start that you did it? You know, that Leland Palmer was the
vehicle?
Well,
yeah, Mark and David, they promised me that they did. They knew it from the start. I don't think that they knew quite how they were going to arrive at that point.
Uh-huh.
But I think that they knew who they wanted it to be, and it was me. I was the sacrificial lamb.
Let's talk about that last scene, the death scene after you confess.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're barking.
Yes.
Whose idea was it for you to bark?
That's me. That's all me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Tim Hunter directed that episode, and Tim did a wonderful job. And but I had all these things sort of planned out in my head, the way I wanted to approach it anyway. The times when I was possessed by Bob, I wanted to exhibit certain things, and then when I became Leland again, I wanted to show certain things. The bark just sort of came out, very feral thing, very wolf-like, very animal-like, and very vicious. And it just seemed to fit with the woods motif. You know, the wolf in the woods, I kind of think so. I did it anyway.
So you've known the secret to who killed Laura Palmer since the summer. Were you, like, pledged to secrecy? And were you protected from the public in any way so that no one would find out?
Yeah, they made us do everything but sign a paper, you know. They stamped numbers on all of our scripts so that if one of our scripts fell into foreign hands, they would know the party responsible for losing it. And I mean, it sounds funny, but it was true that they tried to impose maximum security on the set, and so that no one would know, and so there wouldn't be any leaks. And they even tried to fool the crew sometimes. You know, they would have us do certain scenes with a couple of different actors, and they would film it, actually waste money and waste film to shoot superfluous footage just so that people wouldn't know who the real killer was.
What are some of the ways people try to get you to reveal who killed Laura Palmer?
Well, they just start talking to me. You know, they just start talking to me and asking me supposedly harmless questions. And it's wonderful to be able to talk to you right now with this load off my chest. I don't have anything to protect anymore. I can be pretty truthful, and it's great to feel that way. But people would just start out asking me little questions, seemingly harmless ones, and then try to lead into the big one and try to slip it in by me without my knowing it. But I always clamp down on it and say, look, I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
When you first started to work on Twin Peaks, what kind of overall description and what kind of character description did David Lynch give you?
Well, you know, when I first came in on Twin Peaks, it was originally for the role of Sheriff Truman.
Oh.
And they were David and Mark were seeing me for that role. And then we talked for about, on our first meeting, we talked for about 20 or 25 minutes and about just life in general and the first cars that we owned. I think David's was a Volkswagen, and mine was a little 1960 Alfa Romeo convertible that was in pretty good shape. And anyway, we talked about our cars and a couple of people that we had in common, and then that was the extent of the interview. They called me back a few days later, and my agent said, Ray, you know, they're interested in you for the part of Leland Palmer. And I said, wait a minute, Leland Palmer? Who's he? So I opened up the script, and I quickly rifled through the pages, and, yes, there's Leland Palmer right here. Uh-huh. He hears that his daughter has been murdered, okay? He cries here. He goes to the hospital to identify his daughter's body, and he breaks down and cries here. And I thought, oh, my, this guy is spending a lot of time crying. He's a lot of time with grief. And that was my introduction to Leland Palmer. I had to quickly look him up in the script. And then several days later, we were all chosen for our various parts, and we flew up to Seattle about a week later to begin the pilot, and I thought Leland was a pretty normal, straightforward, simple kind of a guy who was a pretty good lawyer in town, reasonably intelligent, reasonably articulate, who was well-liked, and unfortunately had a young daughter who was murdered. And that's what I thought he was in the beginning.
Actor Ray Wise is my guest. You probably know him as Leland Palmer from Twin Peaks. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor Ray Wise is my guest, and he just finished his acting on Twin Peaks, where he played the role of Leland Palmer. And of course, it was Leland Palmer who killed Laura Palmer, but Leland was inhabited by the evil spirit of Bob at the time. Who came up with that Leland Palmer dance and the weird singing?
Well, the dance, the actual dance that you saw is mine. It's my creation.
Oh, great. Why don't you describe the dance for our listeners who hadn't been following?
The Leland Shuffle?
Yeah.
Leland, through his grief, has become just terribly, terribly sad, just moping around in corners, and he can't seem to be able to deal with the thought that his daughter is gone, that she was murdered violently, and he sort of regresses back to a time in his past when he used to listen to big band music on the record player that his father introduced him to, and he loved that big band music so he would play these songs from that era, the big band music, and they would sort of soothe his spirit a little bit and calm him down and make him feel a little better. When he played these songs, he would naturally kind of do the dance of the time, which was a kind of a modified jitterbug, and he would vary it with some slower steps, and if people were watching very closely, they would have seen that the imaginary partner that Leland was dancing with varied in height from time to time, and that sometimes that person would get very small, and that was little Laura when she was a little girl. And Leland taught her how to dance, and She would stand on his feet and he would take the steps for her. And so all of these things were going through Leland's mind at the time. The soothing music, dancing with his daughter. And then it would become too much for him, and he would start to cry and to wail and sort of hold his head in his hands. And that was the beginning of the Leland Shuffle, doing that modified jitterbug, holding your head in your hands and wailing and crying and dancing with no one. There's nobody there, just dancing with yourself.
You know, I'm thinking in Twin Peaks, a lot of the actors were either considered, like, washed up, you know, like Richard Boehmer, and Peggy Lipton hadn't been on anything for a long time.
Well, you know, we don't like to say washed up. Just out of the public eye.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. And a lot of the actors weren't very well known to the public at all.
Yeah.
So there's an interesting mix of people.
A great mix.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if there was, like, a great esprit de corps because of that. I could see a lot of actors having a special investment in this, because it was a chance to really be before the public in a way that they either hadn't been in a long time or hadn't ever been before.
You're saying it better than I could say it. That is, it's absolutely true. Some of those people, in fact, most of them, Richard Boehmer and Russ Tamblyn, they're just they're joys to work with, and I love them all dearly. And Piper Laurie, and just all the way down the line, the various personalities from different ethnic backgrounds, and we were all thrown together, chosen by David and Mark, who, in their great wisdom, picked a group of people who they knew instinctively would get along, and we did.
In a lot of ways, Twin Peaks was this weird version of a soap opera. Now you did a real afternoon soap opera for about 6 years, Love of Life.
Yes, I did. Uh-huh.
Describe the character you played.
On Love of Life?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I played a guy named Jamie Rollins, and when I started on that show in 1970, he was a college student. He was a kind of a pseudo-hippie radical type who started riots on campus, and one episode, I remember, I caused the president of the university to have a heart attack. That's the way he started. And then 6 years later, he was a lawyer in the district attorney's office. Now, you tell me how that could possibly happen, but it did.
Social realism.
And in that 6.5 years' time, I was a cub reporter on the newspaper, and I had a Marcia Mason there for a while as a girlfriend on the show, and I was almost poisoned by Christopher Reeve, who later turned out to be Superman. He played a character named Ben, and I was a garage mechanic and then a law clerk, and I worked for a judge for a while, and just a million things happened. In the meantime, my wife ran off with my child, and my little child fell through the ice and died, and I had an affair with one of my good friend's wives, and she became pregnant with our illegitimate child, and just a whole slew of things. My best friend died of a rare blood disease. I mean, I can't even tell you all the stuff that happened, but it did.
You obviously have
a lot of fun.
You obviously have a nice sense of irony. Was it hard for you to take the role or the show seriously?
The Love of Life?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sure was. Yeah, it was very hard to take it seriously. But, you know, we tried to do the best we could, and it was a great job. I mean, you learn how to act in front of a camera, and you do it on a daily basis, and you make a pretty good wage, which is always a desirable thing.
In your film career, you've worked with some interesting, very quirky directors. Okay, there's David Lynch from Twin Peaks. Paul Schrader directed you in the remake of Cat People. Wes Craven in Swamp Thing. Yeah. Do you like quirky movies like that?
Well, yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, I do. I enjoy watching them, and I certainly enjoy doing them, being in them.
Yeah.
And I think that because I like to do movies like that, that they sort of gravitate toward me, that these parts become available to me because I want them to be available to me, and I end up doing them. That's the kind of thing I like, and it is true that they seem to suit me, I think.
You're interested in horror. It says in your bio that you have the original 1897 edition of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, I'm steeped in it, yeah.
How'd you get started?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it might have something to do with my Romanian heritage. I'm half Romanian on my mother's side, and And no, I'm sure it doesn't have anything to do with that, because we've been here in this country for many, many years. But but I do enjoy those legends of Count Dracula, Vlad the Impaler, you know, early on in the 14th, 15th century, and the whole vampire mystique. And I love to be scared, you know. I love to lie in bed late at night under the covers and have that book in front of me and shiver a little bit when I read passages, certain passages. And it just, it feels good. It feels to be on the edge, you know, of that kind of danger, literary danger, you know, that isn't life-threatening. It feels pretty good, and I enjoy that feeling.
Now that your character of Leland Palmer is dead,
yeah,
is there any chance you're going to be coming back as an apparition or in a flashback?
Well, from your words up to God's ears. I don't know. I suppose that that's always possible. It would be interesting, and I'm sure that some thought about that has been bandied about. Mm-hmm. They don't miss a trick up there in the Twin Peaks office.
Right. You're at NPR's Los Angeles Bureau now. I'm in Philadelphia. We're not really looking at each other.
Right.
I mean, we can't see each other. So I need to know, is your hair really dark or is it really gray?
Well, oh, you mean my real hair?
Yeah.
My real hair is dark.
Okay.
It's dark brown. So then they had to make my hair white through a terrible chemical process that I don't think anybody should have to endure. But I did for several months, and they had to use major chemicals and large amounts of them to make my hair as white as it looked on the screen. And right now, I'm half and half.
Oh, it's only half grown out?
Yeah, I'm very Madonna-ish, I guess. Very, very dark roots that are about an inch long and then about an inch of white hair on top of that. And it looks, everybody tells me it looks quite good, but I can't imagine that. I'm just giving my hair a breather. I'm letting it rest a little bit now. And I've promised my wife that I'm going to get a cut within the next couple of weeks.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. It's been a lot of fun to meet Ray Wise.
Yeah, it's great talking to you. A lot of people, they've seen a lot of Leland, but not a lot of Ray, and it's nice to talk to you.
Actor Ray Wise. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. President Bush has decided to lift temporarily restrictions of the Jackson-Vanik Amendment to help the Soviet Union with food shortages in that country. Lauro Cavazos is resigning as Secretary of Education. We'll talk with two combat veterans, a veteran of World War II and Korea and Vietnam, who definitely supports the president's actions and possible intentions in the Persian Gulf. And with a Vietnam vet who says the soldier has the absolute right to question the moral judgment that's used in a decision to go to war. It's the second part of our series about what is worth dying for. Also, Bob Mondello reviews the new Sidney Pollack, Robert Redford film, Havana.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Novelist George V. Higgins has a new mystery, Victories. Higgins writes dialogue that uses underworld slang, and that's part of the reason linguist Jeffrey Nunberg is a fan. Reading Higgins, Jeff says, makes him reflect about the fate of slang.
I recall seeing a survey once that showed that a bunch of British critics had ranked George V. Higgins among the five greatest post-war American novelists. I don't know why Higgins is a prophet with so much less honor here. It may be that Americans are no longer interested in the criminal demi-monde that Higgins writes about. Nowadays, we seem to prefer the imported genteel delinquency of P.D. James or the officially sanctioned thuggery of international spies. It's a change of taste that shows up in the language as well, in the sad decline of slang. Since Shakespeare's time, the English language and its literature have been enriched by the language of thieves, gypsies, vagabonds, and their colleagues. Dictionaries and glossaries of slang began to appear as early as the 16th century. I have an 1811 edition of Captain Gross's Dictionary of Buckish Slang and Pickpocket Eloquence as revised by a member of the Whip Club, assisted by Hellfire Dick. It lists such words as curmudgeon, cocksure, crony, bully, and slang itself, all of which eventually passed into standard usage. A lot of this language was first made popular to polite society in what the 19th century called Newgate novels, named after the prison. These were enormously popular romances about rogues and highwaymen, which were sometimes so laced with underworld slang that they required footnotes. Thackeray parodied the genre in Vanity Fair. Is that your snum? I'll gully the dag and bimble the clicky in a snuffkin. A few Victorian reformers made an effort to portray the underworld in something more like its sordid reality. Dickens wrote Oliver Twist as a kind of corrective to the Newgate novel. But the genre remained popular through the end of the century. The fascination is easy enough to understand. For the Victorians and their successors, the underworld was just what its name implied, a nether region as dark and elaborately structured as Dante's. It was the repository of all of the violent and erotic currents that respectable society couldn't acknowledge in itself, and it provided names for all the things that respectable people found literally unspeakable. There was a similar vogue for underworld language in pre-war America. Thanks to the gangster movie and the detective thriller, the voices of the yegg and the grifter were heard everywhere in the land. As Sam Spade put it in The Maltese Falcon, the cheaper the crook, the gaudier the patter. But most Americans were titillated rather than disdainful. The fashion was satirized in Bringing Up Baby, where society girl Katharine Hepburn starts spouting gangster lingo in order to convince a Connecticut constable that she's really Swinging Door Susie, an escaped con.
Get wine to yourself. The heat's on, Jerry.
Jerry? Jerry? Ain't his name Bone?
Well,
of course it isn't Bone.
Ah, you mean to say you don't remember Jerry the Nipper?
Jerry the Nipper? Make a note of that, Doc.
Constable, she's making all this up out of motion pictures,
you
see.
But the romance of the underworld died with the notion of respectable society itself. The professional criminals are still around, of course, the working-class safecrackers, con men, and car thieves that Higgins brings to life in his novels. But once the middle class cut loose, it no longer had to live vicariously through underworld language. It's true that a lot of middle-class slang still comes from the language of inner-city blacks, who have always been perceived as citizens of the underworld in the white American scheme of things. But most of it has come from the specialized lifestyles of the white middle class itself, from the language of hippies, surfers, hot tubbers, yuppies, druggies, and hackers. The trouble is that their worlds aren't shrouded in forbidden mysteries, and their words don't evoke the salacious tingling that slang could set off in Victorian ears.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with production assistance from Roberta Shurrock, Joan Tuohy, and Sue Spolin. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at cemeteries, the cities of the dead that have a lot to tell us about the cities of the living. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.